Welcome to Bits About Books, the home for conversations with authors of breakthrough books on sales, marketing, and business. Founders, entrepreneurs, and individual professionals, we all need to keep track of ideas that are helping create our today and tomorrow. Bits About Books will strive to find those books and speak to their authors, go behind the scenes and understand what inspired the authors to write the books that they did and how they went about doing so. Through our conversations, we hope to gain insights that will help us to get the most out of our efforts. I'm your host Shubhanjan Sarkar, founder of PitchLink, the next generation buyer-seller engagement platform where our mission is to make buying easy. Welcome to Bits About Books. Thank you for your time and for joining us in this session. I have a favor to ask. While you continue to listen to the podcast, please leave a comment or rating at iTunes or wherever else you get your podcasts from. I personally look at each comment and will give you a shout out to each of you in our following episodes. It means a lot to hear from you. Our guest today is Radhika Dutt, and we speak with her about her sensational international bestseller, Radical Product Thinking, The New Mindset for Innovating Smarter.
Our vision at the time, even that vision is very telling. Our vision was to revolutionize wireless. This was back in 2000. And, you know, that vision tells you really nothing about what were we solving, right? It was all about being big. And that hero syndrome that we encountered, you know, more than 20 years ago, is still just as prevalent in the industry today. And so the question was, is it that we're all just doomed to learn from trial and error? Or can we give people a systematic step-by-step process so that anyone can build world-changing products?
Radhika Dutt is the author of Radical Product Thinking, The New Mindset for Innovating Smarter, which has been translated into several languages, including Chinese and Japanese. She's an entrepreneur and product leader who has participated in 5 acquisitions, 2 of which were companies that she founded. She advises organizations from high-tech startups to government agencies on building radical products that create fundamental change. She is currently advisor on product thinking to the Monetary Authority of Singapore and serves on the board of the independent publisher, Berit Queller. Radhika has built products in a wide range of industries, including broadcast, media and entertainment, telecom, advertising technology, government, consumer apps, robotics, and even wine. She graduated from MIT with an SB and MEng in electrical engineering and speaks 9 languages. Now on to this thought-provoking session with Radhika Dutt. Radhika, welcome to Bits About Books. I'm delighted that I could get you for this discussion. It's such a interesting and important book, and we'll get into that in a bit. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Thank you, Radhika. So why did you think that there was a need for a book like this?
It really came out of my experience and the realization that it's hard to build products in a vision-driven way. You know, a lot of what we've learned until now is the way you build products is just launch something in the market and see what works. And what I've realized through my own career is when you try that, it doesn't work. If you think about kind of how this approach started of just launch something and see what works, it really originated in the VC business model. So basically, you know, the VC business model is you launch 10 different companies and you just need one of them to succeed. The rest all, in fact, you want them to fail quickly so that you don't have middling companies. So it's either fail fast, learn fast. That's kind of where it comes from. So what I realized was, you know, there was this really strong survivor bias where there are a few companies that took this approach of just trying to see what works in the market, seeing what sticks. And those few companies that succeeded and became unicorns kind of drove an entire model and a way of thinking that this is how we build products. And the way this manifests itself and why this is a problem, right, is I found that there are product diseases that are just so common in terms of what goes wrong, like fatal product diseases that kill innovation and good products. And I experienced some of these myself across my career. So I'll give you a few examples. You know, when I graduated from MIT, the first startup that we had, it was called Lobby 7. And we ran into a disease I call hero syndrome, which is where, you know, we were all about going big. It was all about scale. Our vision at the time, even that vision is very telling. Our vision was to revolutionize wireless. This was back in 2000. And, you know, that vision tells you really nothing about what were we solving, right? It was all about being big. And that hero syndrome that we encountered, you know, more than 20 years ago, is still just as prevalent in the industry today. And so the main thesis was, after running into these product diseases and learning hard lessons and learning how to avoid product diseases, I was observing other companies and people run into those same diseases. And so the question was, is it that we're all just doomed to learn from trial and error? Or can we give people a systematic step-by-step process so that anyone can build world-changing products? And that was how the idea for radical product thinking started. And initially, you know, when I shared this frustration with 2X colleagues, they had encountered some of these same product diseases. And so we said, we have to write a book, but let's first test out this idea. So we created this framework of radical product thinking, and we put it out there as a free toolkit. And by the way, it's still a free toolkit that you can download. We launched this free toolkit and people started using it. And in fact, we were presenting radical product thinking at a conference and someone came by saying, oh my gosh, are you guys the ones who actually created radical product thinking? And we felt like mini celebrities, you know, but we had just launched the toolkit and this woman was telling us that she had found it and she had then presented it at a conference in Mexico. And we realized that there was really this need for something to help people through the step-by-step process for how do you build great products. And that's how the book originated.
So which year was this in terms of chronology? When was it that you launched the framework?
That was in 2017.
Okay.
And the book came out in 2021 in September.
How long did it take you? I mean, obviously that experience of 2000 and between then and 2017, lots had happened. So what happened between then and 2017, which sort of propelled this thought, and obviously it germinated at some other point and you started thinking and then you put that framework out. So was there something happening towards this?
So in 2000, that was the startup that I told you about, yeah, where we ran into hero syndrome. And by the way, that startup, what we ended up building there was an early version of Siri. So allowing people to interact with their phones using voice as well as text. But if you think about 2000, like that was way before, you know, the iPhone came out, and we were entirely too early to market, right? So we hadn't thought about what's the clear definition of what's the problem statement we're solving for. Mm. And so the company got acquired, but it wasn't a huge life-changing event for us in any way. So after that, I went into other startups, and there we encountered other diseases. But in 2003, I started working at Avid. And that was a really positive experience that really contrasted some of these iteration-led diseases. And that really showed me that there is an alternative, a better alternative to building products in this vision-driven way. And that example at Avid was, you know, Avid was a company where we were very successful in the Hollywood industry. Like practically every movie that was ever made was edited on Avid products. And so Avid at the time was this wonderful winner in Hollywood, but they were approaching the broadcast market. And, you know, at the time, Sony dominated broadcast and the newsroom. And the head of Avid's broadcast, his name is David Schleifer at the time, he had a vision for broadcast. And, you know, his vision was, he felt like if we are able to build exactly what broadcasters need, we can really get them to transition from Sony and tape into digital. My role at Avid was to figure out what is it that these customers actually need. And in fact, funny enough, my title at the time was Program Manager for Custom Engineering, which, if you think about it, right, is the diametric opposite of anything product. There I was with the title of Custom Engineering. But what we were really doing, my role was about figuring out what was truly custom that customers, our broadcast customers, wanted versus what are some common needs. And then based on that, figuring out what was strategic for us to build and getting our customers to buy into our vision, partner with us, and in fact, pay for some of this development. And that is what we did. And within 5 years, Avid went from being this newcomer to completely dominating the market. And we had overpowered Sony. And we had won every major broadcaster. And so that was the lesson where David had this clear vision, but, you know, I was 28 at the time, right? And yet I was able to take his vision, and there I was negotiating with executives in newsrooms about what we were going to build or not build. I was able to take that vision and translate it into my vision for what our products were going to do and be able to feel so empowered. And that was a lesson for how we can build vision-driven products. It's not a matter of one visionary just saying, this is my vision, everyone else is going to follow me. But rather, it's someone who has a vision, but they're able to communicate the vision so that every person on the team feels empowered and knows exactly how to translate that vision into everyday activities and into a product. And so that was one major lesson after 2000, and after 2000, actually. So this was back in 2003 until 2005. 2008. And so after that, I went to other companies and, you know, I learned this tactic of having this clarity of vision. And so I was able to apply this to other industries. And so my career then spanned across, you know, from broadcast to telecom, then it was advertising, wine, even robotics. And I was able to apply this vision-driven mindset. And those were some of the key realizations that, you know, we can apply this product-driven approach to any industry, to any role. It's all about how can you build these systematic, how can you build world-changing products systematically, no matter where you are in the organization. It's really a mindset. And so it was all of these learnings that sort of came together, which culminated in frustration in 2017, where I was feeling like everyone seems doomed to having to learn this through trial and error, and what can we do differently?
Post 2017, you were doing conferences, you released this framework, you saw people using it, and then you sort of felt that steps are fine, but there are gaps for people to understand what exactly those steps are. And we need to sort of elaborate that into a more usable manual, so to say.
Exactly. That's exactly what happened. A lot of people would reach out saying, do you have an example of this filled out? It became clear that there was a voiceover over the toolkit that was needed with real world examples. And that's where the need for this book came up.
Right, right. Does the book reflect the framework like faithfully, or did it take a different shape when it got written?
There were some key changes from the framework itself into what was written. There were a couple of additional parts that I added on. So one example of a change was, well, first of all, just wording changes, because some things, you know, we realized as people in the framework on the website, for example, for prioritization, I use this 2x2 of vision versus sustainability. But sustainability has this connotation of environmental sustainability. Mm-hmm. And instead, we use the words survival, which made more sense for people. And so it was vision versus survival in the book, which made a lot more sense. But other changes, one big thing was I developed this idea of how do you use these ideas of vision, strategy, prioritization, and execution and measurement to really create a culture that we need in companies to be able to innovate better. And so I created a framework for how do you use these elements to make culture more tangible and not just something that, you know, sounds like this fluffy thing that people roll eyes when you say we need a culture change. Mm-hmm. So that was an element added. And the last thing that was an additional element in this book was the idea of how do we use this in a responsible way? You know, the whole radical product thinking framework, I've realized, is a superpower where you can build successful products, but with great power comes great responsibility. And we have to use this to create the change that we intend. And it's important to recognize kind of when you don't create that change you intend, you create what I call digital pollution. And there are so many examples of digital pollution out there. When our products are fueling misinformation, when they're fueling increasing inequality, when we continue to hijack people's attention so that they can't engage in deep thought, all of these, right, when we erode privacy, all of these are creating digital pollution. And so it's a way of thinking about ethics and creating change intentionally and deliberately using the radical product thinking framework that I also included in the book.
One question comes to my mind. I mean, how many companies can actually be engaged in world-changing product creation? If you think of the ecosystem, not everybody will be able to do that, right?
Yeah, let's define what world-changing means.
Yeah, okay.
You know, one of the symptoms of hero syndrome is thinking that you're changing the world for everyone. But if we're truly honest with ourselves, you know, we really aren't trying to change the world for everyone or shouldn't be. You really have to think about whose world are you really setting out to change? And it might be a small group of people, but an identifiable group. And in fact, one of the biggest mistakes that happens in product is we say, you know, we're building this for everyone, right? And when you try to build a product for everyone, it really works for no one. And so when one of the key things, the starting points of the radical product thinking framework is this clarity of vision. And the first step in answering what is your vision is to start with, whose world are you changing? And I'll give you a quick example. You know, there was one company that was working, they said, to make justice a more democratic process, to make justice accessible to all. Right? And if you then looked at what they actually built, it was a set of tools that they had built for lawyers. And in fact, the lawyers who were using them were the big law firms and not the small ones who were doing any pro bono work. Hmm. So if you think about whose world are they actually changing, it felt righteous to say that they were making justice accessible to all. What they were really doing was empowering, you know, the big law firms to be even more efficient, right? And so let's be really honest, intellectually honest, in terms of whose world are we actually trying to change? And that's the starting point of your vision. And what I mean by world changing is you're creating that change for a certain group of users that you're very clear about.
That's very interesting, because I think a lot of companies struggle in identifying a niche. I mean, it's sort of, in other words, it's figuring out who you're building it for and so on. Identifying a niche, not because they don't want to, but what I have figured, and you can tell me because you have seen a lot more than I have, it's actually difficult to nail that. Yeah. It is not about trial and error. It's not about who is going to pay you first. It is about really figuring out what would be, in your parlance, what would be the niche which will be sustainable. I may find a niche which may not help me build the business at all. So that's not going to work. So essentially, to find a niche for whom I'll be changing things need to be a sustainable niche for the business. So and that's a very difficult thing to do, actually.
Right. But the good thing is this framework gives you a set of questions that you have to answer. And that is your stake in the ground. Like, you have to start with a stake in the ground. And the five questions to create this vision are, you know, whose world are you trying to change? what exactly is the problem that they have right now? And how are they solving it today? The third question is, why is the status quo unacceptable? Because if you cannot answer why is it absolutely unacceptable, maybe there's no need for your product. And then you can say, what's the world you envision once, so that you can say mission accomplished. And lastly, how are you going to bring that about? The problem that you just mentioned, where companies realize that here's maybe someone who has a problem, but maybe, you know, it isn't worth, that's not something they're going to pay for. That goes to that third question of why is that status quo unacceptable? You know, sometimes companies go after problems that, well, you know, it's great if we solve, but it's not a desperate need. There's no good answer to why is the status quo absolutely unacceptable? And that's when, if you can't answer that question, that sometimes requires facing reality that maybe you're going after trying to solve the wrong problem, or, you know, maybe the answer to your who is incorrect. So start by creating this stake in the ground, by answering the who, what, why, when, and how, and then you might discover that your answers, you know, you're realizing that they're not good enough and you have to go back to the drawing board. But that is where, you know, you're bringing everyone with you on the journey within your team. What happens often in the startup world is this disease I called pivotitis, which means, you know, you start off doing one thing, soon you try your next thing because, oh, this isn't working. And then you try another thing. And, you know, the common thinking in the startup world is you just keep trying things until you figure out what works, right? And that is where you run into pivotitis. And what I'm suggesting instead is, yes, you do need to pivot occasionally, but you have literally 2 to 3 pivots before you run out of money or momentum. And so you have to be really deliberate about pivots. And by answering the who, what, why, when, and how, you're being very deliberate about pivots so that the next time you have to pivot, you're going to be able to tell your team, here's what we discovered, here's what we need to do differently, and why we're pivoting. So you're bringing everyone with you on the journey, and every pivot has gravitas. It's not just, oh, we'll just pivot and it's pivotitis.
Right. I get you. And we see that again and again. And although I'll not go back to your comment on the VC model, which I believe is great for VCs, but terrible for startups. But that's a topic for another day and possible another book. But we'll talk about it later. Let's dive into the book now. The first part is about innovating smarter requires a new mindset. So what is this old mindset and what is the new mindset are we talking about here?
The old mindset was really about being iteration led, which was, let's just keep trying things. Let me give an example. And in the book, I talk about this example of Boeing and, you know, how they had this iteration mindset. What happens often, right, is when you don't have a clarity of vision or strategy, what happens is your default thinking is always short-term thinking and optimizing for the short term. So if we look at Boeing's example, what happened? Boeing built their 737 platform, that body and an engine, et cetera. They built that platform about 4 decades ago. And so, you know, that platform was their best-selling cash cow that they kept making small iterations on over time. And so, you know, everyone at Boeing realized that they needed a new narrow-body narrow-body plane. And they were actually planning on building a new narrow-body plane from scratch, just like they had built the Dreamliner from scratch. But what happened? You know, they kept wanting to show short-term results and be able to show, you know, shareholder performance, etc. So they kept delaying building this narrow-body plane. Eventually, what happened was Airbus, which was their competitor, came up with A320neo. And, you know, they built this narrow body plane, which then started selling better than Boeing's. And in fact, when Boeing's customers, which were traditionally Boeing only fleets, started to use Airbus, Boeing knew that they needed to do something differently. So what did they do? They said, okay, let's just take the 737 platform and we'll stick bigger engines under the frame. So, and all the engineers rolled their eyes that they were going to have to again use the same 737 platform. So they were again doing this iteration, this small iteration to the status quo. And what happened? Well, these engines were too big to put under this frame. And so, because this frame was too low, by the way. And so what happened? They ended up realizing that it was causing aerodynamic instability. And so these engines, these planes were prone to stalling when they were at cruising altitude. And so to compensate for that, Boeing built this feature where the plane's nose would get pointed downwards to avoid stalling. And this is what led to the two crashes and over 300 fatalities, right? It was this constant iteration. And this is what I'm saying we need to do differently. You need this clarity of vision. And if you look at Boeing's vision, what was their vision? It was to be this, I forget the exact words, and I have it in the book, but it was something like being the leader in aerospace. But what exactly does that mean? How do you measure being this leader? And, you know, that leadership in aerospace engineering could mean the best shareholder results. And in fact, you know, Boeing spent like 43, how much was it? I think it was almost $43 billion on share buybacks. It was a huge number, but I have the exact numbers in the book. Sure. What exactly does this leadership mean? Like, is it about sales? And in which case, you know, yes, they delivered quick sales as a result of releasing the 737 MAX, right? So we need this clarity of what is a good vision and what is a good strategy so that we can build products driven by that vision and not just keep making small iterations.
It's time for a short break. Stay with us. After the break.
That's not the way good leadership works. Instead, you know, instead of just dictating what is number one, two, or three, or 15 on your list, you have to be able to share your rationale so that everyone in the company understands how you're making trade-offs so that even when you can't be in that meeting, even when they're making decisions about coding, they know how you think and therefore they're able to make decisions like you.
You are listening to a Business Podcast Network original. Podcasting is the fastest growing content marketing opportunity, which is untapped. We can help you craft your audio strategy and help leverage the wide reach and easy streaming capability that the smartphone penetration provides. It is easy, it is powerful, and personal. Talk to us to find out how podcasting can help you build your brand and reach out to your targets like never before. Write to us at bpn@bizcast.in. That is bpn@bizcast.in. Business Podcast Network. Podcasts end to end.
Welcome back. I'm Shubhanjan Sarkar, your host for Bits About Books and founder of PitchLink, the buyer-seller engagement platform. Let's dive right back into the episode where we left it. So you touched upon this idea of the five elements of the framework, right? Would you like to elaborate on that a bit? That's your second part of the book.
Yes, exactly. So the five elements are vision, strategy, prioritization, execution and measurement, and culture. But when I say these words, right, it sounds like, oh, I've heard all of these words. So what's radical about it? And so that's why I want to start by giving a taste of what do I mean by radical vision? So earlier we were talking about answering those five questions of who, what, why, when, and how. But in the radical product thinking framework, you know, vision is a fill-in-the-blank statement where you're not focusing on big words or a short slogan that sounds inspiring and pithy. No, instead, it's almost an essay, but that really articulates the problem statement and the solution. And I want to give you an example. So here's a vision statement for a startup I had in the wine industry that I started in 2011 and sold in 2014. So it would go like this in the radical product thinking format. Today, when amateur wine drinkers want to find wines that they're likely to like and learn about wine, they have to pick wines based on attractive looking wine labels or find wines that are on sale. this is unacceptable because this leads to so many disappointments, and it's hard to learn about wine in this way. We envision a world where finding wines you like and buying them is as easy as finding movies you like on Netflix. We're bringing about this world through a personalized recommendations algorithm that gives you recommendations based on your taste and an operational setup that delivers these wines to your door. Now, if you hear this vision, right, I had told you absolutely nothing about my startup, but hopefully it was super clear just what we were doing and why we were doing it. And that's the power of a radical vision, that it really helps bring everyone with you on the journey, aligns your team, but also your customers in providing this clarity of what is the problem you're solving and why. So that's the starting point. But then you translate this into a really clear, actionable strategy. And in terms of prioritization, this is another element where it challenges traditional thinking. You know, traditional thinking is that leadership tells everyone, here are our priorities. This is number one, two, and three, and you just go execute. Whereas in the radical product thinking model, that's not the way good leadership works. Instead, you know, instead of just dictating what is number one, two, or three, or 15 on your list, you have to be able to share your rationale so that everyone in the company understands how you're making trade-offs, so that even when you can't be in that meeting, even when they're making decisions about coding, they know how you think, and therefore they're able to make decisions like you. So how do we do that in the radical product thinking model? Well, now we've talked about this clarity of vision, and next, we have to think about, and the vision, by the way, is the long term. So if you think about how you prioritize, intuitively, you're prioritizing the long term against the short term. And so if you think about the short term, how do you define survival? If you're a startup, your biggest survival risk is running out of money. On the other hand, if you are a big company, think of Boeing, you know, you have the money in the bank, but your biggest survival risk is probably stakeholder risk. So if your boss or your boss's boss, your board of directors disapproves of what you're doing, that's the end of your product, right? And so now that you have clarity on how you define long-term versus short-term, you can now actually make this explicit for your team on an X and a Y axis. So your Y axis is vision, your X axis is survival. And if you're doing things that are good for both vision and survival, well, great, you know, that's ideal, that's good for you. But if you only focus on ideal, that means you're always still being short-term driven, and that's still being myopic. So sometimes you have to invest in the vision. So if we think about the Boeing example, the fact, like, if they had actually built a narrow-body plane from scratch, the way they did the Dreamliner, when they built the Dreamliner, for example, that was investing in the vision, because you don't see short-term results, but it's important for the long-term vision. And the opposite of investing in the vision is sometimes you take on vision debt. This is where, you know, you maybe have to survive, and so you're building a custom feature, but it's not good for the long-term vision. The problem with Boeing was they kept taking on vision debt, meaning they kept reusing the same 737 platform, never invested in the vision and actually built that new narrow-body plane. So when you take on too much vision debt, that's a disease I call obsessive sales disorder. So you think about priorities in this holistic way. There are no absolutes, but you agree as a team on how are you trading off long-term and short-term, and that's good leadership.
That's great. And how does culture fit into this?
So in terms of culture, you know, the way culture is often this nebulous idea of, you know, we need a good culture. But what I realized is, just like you need a vision for a good product, you also need a vision for a good culture. How do you define a good culture? And so what I realized is we can think about culture as a set of accumulated or cumulative experiences at an organization. So how do you think about your cumulative experiences? You can think about it on two axes. One axis is the level of urgency that you feel, right? And the other axis is whether work is fulfilling or not. And so if you think about work that's both fulfilling and it's not urgent, that's the meaningful work. You know, when you have mental and emotional bandwidth to think about strategy, to think about long-term, that's, you know, fulfilling, meaningful work. Then there is meaningful work or rather fulfilling work, but that is urgent, right? And so if you have a little bit of this, it adds some spice to your workday, right? The example of this is like firefighting to fix an issue for a client. So that I call heroism quadrant, where it's fulfilling but urgent. But if you do too much of this in your workday, then it's exhausting and you're on the fast track to burnout. And then there's the other quadrant, which I call organizational cactus. This is where it's work that's not fulfilling, but it's urgent. Examples of this would be, you know, I have to fill out expense reports. I have to get consensus from 15 different people before I build a feature. It's organizational cactus because it feels like so much work and it's not meaningful. And then the last quadrant is soul sucking. This is neither fulfilling work, nor is it urgent, but it feels like this constant inflammation or fever, right? And so this is examples like where I have to manage my boss and I have to manage kind of, I often self-censor to not speak up, etc. And so if I think about culture, you know, at any organization, your cumulative experiences are across these four quadrants. In a good culture, your meaningful quadrant is the biggest and the danger quadrants are the smallest. In a bad culture, the danger quadrants, like soul-sucking quadrant, is huge. You know, you might have a lot of heroism where you have to constantly prove yourself, etc. And so a vision for a good culture means, you know, how am I going to maximize this meaningful quadrant and minimize the other three? And that is where you can then craft a detailed strategy. Think about priorities so that you can actually action against this vision. And then execution and measurement so that you can test whether you're creating the culture that you envisioned. Is the meaningful quadrant actually any bigger than it was before? And so the way you do this is through actually, you know, asking a set of maybe pulse surveys that you do once in a while, just three or four questions to be able to test for specific changes that you were trying to make. So all of these ideas are so that you can engineer the culture that you want very systematically. And it uses the same framework of vision, strategy, priorities, and execution and measurement.
Yeah. So one quick question that comes to my mind is, if you are an organization which already either built or inherited a culture which is somewhere in between and you feel the necessity to change, from your experience, how easy it is? Because when I talk to people about culture, one of the things that I hear is if you have somehow, you know, built something which is not acceptable, changing it becomes extremely difficult.
Right. I completely agree. So culture change and any change, by the way, any form of transformation, even digital transformation, it's not easy. And so because change is hard, you really need buy-in from the whole team, from the organization on the need for this change. And if you don't have that buy-in, trying to make any change is really impossible, especially in a large organization. And so one of the first things that you need is to have a vision for change. So if I think about, you know, whether it's culture change or digital transformation, when I work with clients, the first thing I work on is, what's our vision for transformation? What's the problem statement? And it's the same idea of, you know, if we cannot define why the status quo is unacceptable, we shouldn't bother trying to make this change. And in fact, you know, one organization that works on diversity, equity, and inclusion, they work on DEI consulting, and the organization is called Brevity and Wit. They use the radical product thinking framework and specifically the vision to be able to define a vision for DEI. Because if you don't have a vision for DEI, don't even try to start this process. You'll face so much resistance that the effort to change just becomes, it's like the organization develops antibodies to a foreign agent, right? It's like a body rejecting change. And that's what happens unless you have that clarity of vision.
Yeah, I mean, I can imagine that. And also the commitment to see it through, because somehow we live in an era where our expectation is that changes will manifest themselves quickly. Mm-hmm. So I mean, that same long-term versus short-term thing, right? So everything needs to be short-term. Everything is linked to the quarterly report. So let's move to part three, and you're talking of, I would say, the philosophical basis of what you have written in the rest of the book. It appears to me like that. So elaborate a bit about the points that you touched there, including digital pollution, ethics, etc.
So the main philosophy of the radical product thinking approach is that we must think about our product as a mechanism to create change. And, you know, when we think about this product as a mechanism to create change, like, one of the most important things to realize is that each of us is creating change through our work. We're creating a certain change in the world. And so the question we must ask ourselves is the change that we're creating, is it what we intend? Is it making the world kind of what you envision for it? Or, you know, are we being like Facebook and saying, oh, whoops, you know, we created unintended consequences? And the thing that I find often frustrating in the tech world is, you know, you can see that we have created unintended consequences in the past. So one would say, okay, you know, I have seen that I've done this in the past, so moving forward, I'm going to do this differently. But no, we don't learn from those mistakes, right? So let's look at the example of ChatGPT being released. You know, we've said in the past that when we've released products too early without thinking about how it contributes to misinformation, there's a real danger. So you would think, well, okay, does this mean we create products and build products more deliberately, or that we try to avoid unintended consequences? That's not really happening, right? And what often happens is we look at the need for regulations as kind of an easy out. So if you look at Sam Altman, you know, of OpenAI, he often says, well, ChatGPT, we always knew that there was so much danger in releasing that. We need regulations really quickly. Well, that's basically shedding your responsibility and deflecting that to government and saying, oh, you have to regulate, you know, we'll just release until you regulate. And that I find is really unacceptable, right? So we, as employees, as people who are building products, or as founders, no matter where you are in the organization, we have to think about, well, what is the change that I intend in the world? You know, we care about environmental pollution, but just similar to environmental pollution, we have to look at digital pollution as something that's fraying the fabric of society, you know, through misinformation, increasing polarization, inequality, etc. We're really fraying this fabric of society. And so the question we need to ask ourselves is, how much do you want to contribute to that digital pollution? And if the answer is that you care about this fabric of society, then we have to realize that we vote for the world that we want to create through our labor. And so we have to be deliberate in terms of what's the work that I'm going to take on and what are the products that I'm going to work on as a result. And so this radical product thinking approach is something that you can use even as you build your vision for the product that you're working on. Maybe you're not the product manager for this product. Maybe you're not the CEO. Maybe you're not a VP level. I mean, you might be an engineer. But still, think about the vision for this product. What is your vision? What's the change you hope you're going to create out of this product? If you're working on ChatGPT or GPT-4, I mean, think about what is your vision. And if your vision isn't coming alive through the features that you're working on, Well, it is important to consider, you know, should you be working on something else instead?
Yeah, I think that's so critical, because a lot of the paradigm of ethics or paradigm of issues that we need to address have actually shifted. We are not living in the same world that we lived in 20 years back, and we cannot just ignore all of that, right? It cannot be that oh, I don't care about your privacy till a GDPR or a CCPA comes through, and then I'll start thinking about doing it. But till then, it's free for all, and it's the Wild West, and I can sort of do whatever I think I can do with the data that you are inadvertently sharing with me, thinking that there'll be no misuse of that, right?
Right.
It's exactly the same thing, and I think our technology leadership has not shown any difference from the ancestors who sort of dug into the earth and didn't think of the environment when things could have been easier to manage. So I think there is no change in character or approach when you look at it today.
Exactly. And one of the issues is, you know, when we are employees in a big company, it is really hard to see how your work is contributing to this digital pollution, because each of us is working on one small little piece. So in fact, a really good friend of mine went to work at Google, and I was like, okay, you know, you have so many choices of where you could go work. What led you to take this path? And she's like, well, I'm only working on this portion. And, you know, that is exactly how we think about it, right? Like, yeah, we think about our little niche and where we're working, but we don't think about kind of how all of these systems come together and what is the change you're contributing to in the world as a result. And increasingly, I think we have to start considering that, because we have seen repeatedly that it's not, you know, company leadership that has these incentives to change what they do. That power really increasingly lies in people who are actually building those products. Yeah. And you kind of can decide where or what you're voting for through your labor. You know, in the past, people used to say, well, we let consumers vote with their dollar. And, you know, like the example that you gave of, unless, you know, GDPR, et cetera, came along, I mean, as a consumer, you have very little power. Everyone was violating all of these privacy issues.
Absolutely.
You really can't vote with your labor. So it's these false premises that we have created for ourselves, because we don't want to think about our work creating any bad in the world, right? Nobody wants to feel that way. But this is why it's important to think about digital pollution and more deeply about our work.
Absolutely. Radhika, this was a very, very interesting discussion. And I think there is so much that one needs to sort of keep in the public domain. I mean, we do not do enough discussion of these kinds. I mean, like the OpenAI example you just shared. I mean, we have learned nothing from the Facebook experiences. I mean, we say, oh, it's a different thing. But it's not really. I mean, it's the same thought process. And basically, the common man who is the user always ends up with the short end of the stick.
Right, exactly. And it's not like people haven't warned before. There have been papers by Tim Gebru, for example, who was saying that large language models are going to pose a problem for creating equity. And, you know, ChatGPT, GPT-4, it uses large language models. And we are seeing that, yes, it does cause issues, right? So we've known that this was going to be a problem. Just like people had said for a long time, long before Facebook actually posed problems, people had recognized that Facebook was going to cause it. I think what is important is that we have to recognize that and then decide as a society, like, you know, where the power lies. And at the moment, while regulators are thinking about what to do, I think the power lies among employees and what we choose to do.
Yeah. It's a difficult situation, because civil society, irrespective of how we look at it, has very little power to really. I mean, so it's easy to say, oh, boycott the product or boycott the service. It's not easy to do that for various reasons, and I think the alternate model has to emerge somewhere. I'm sure it will, but that's maybe a few years or decades away.
Bits About Books is brought to you by PitchLink, the buyer-seller engagement platform. PitchLink makes buying easy by enabling high-quality engagement between buyers and sellers through its presentation and discussion modules. Sellers create customized sales narratives using sales collaterals and personal videos, and reach out to prospects through a non-intrusive, buyer-qualified engagement.
PitchLink requires no installation or download and holds the entire repository of sales collaterals and buyer-seller conversations. Talk to us to know more about how you can engage with customers without intrusion. Call us on 99021-631-32.
Radhika, thank you again for joining me today for this session. And I really enjoyed this chat. And I hope that people who read your book will find value in this discussion and context in what they read in the book and make better use of it.
Thank you so much. This was such a pleasure. And I really enjoyed our conversation. Thank you for the insightful question.
We have a fantastic lineup over the next couple of episodes with great conversations on breakthrough books. Subscribe in your favorite podcast app so you do not miss a single episode. Thanks for listening.
Thank you for being with us today on Bits About Books, where we talk to authors about breakthrough books on sales, marketing, and business. We hope this conversation helped inform and motivate as we all navigate a rapidly changing business environment. For us, these are enlightening conversations enriched with knowledge and expertise. We encourage you to go out and buy the book to learn firsthand and implement some of the great ideas we discussed today. We hope to have you with us again in the next exciting episode of Bits About Books. If you liked what you heard, subscribe to the show in your favorite podcast platforms like iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever else you get your podcasts from, and give us a rating while you are at it.
This BizCast original podcast is produced for PitchLink, the next generation buyer-seller engagement platform, where the mission is to make buying easy. Hosted by Subhanjan Sarkar and produced by Rajiv Aditya. See you next time and have a wonderful day.